right. Hello there, everybody. Well, welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me as always is...
Scotty Hertz from the CFRU News Team, and today on the show we're going to spend the hour talking about whether Kate Middleton actually took that picture of Prince Louis. We'll have guests. No, I'm just kidding. Taking bets, though, that, you know, did she really do it or no? This was everywhere a day ago, right?
Because it was his birthday.
Maybe is he digitally altered or not? This is the question.
Maybe there isn't.
There's nobody asking that. I don't know.
Maybe there was never any Prince Louis. Maybe he was always an AI creation.
Well, yeah. See, that's a possibility, right?
Yeah, I'm putting that out there.
That's why we need the hour to talk about it.
It's too bad CFRU doesn't have the budget for a royal correspondent.
Oh. Mm. Well, you get a volunteer, maybe.
I think that's about all it's worth. But anyway, Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can find us here every Thursday at 5 p.m. as we talk about the latest news items from Guelph, Ontario, Canada, and around the world. And we sometimes interview local newsmakers and politicians, which this week will be Prince Louis. No, I'm just kidding. It's Ward 1 City Councilor Aaron Caton is going to talk to us about social media training for council, internet voting, and other tech-savvy issues, because they are the tech-savvy city councilor. So that's going to be at the bottom half of the hour. Before that, we're going to talk about a few news items from the last week, including transit. The government of Ontario last week announced regional transit improvements, but not everywhere is improved equally. So what will it take to get better GO service up around this end of the map? But first, Ukraine's kind of fallen off the map, at least still there, of course, still under siege by Russia. But there is reason for some hope today, as Joseph Robinette Biden Jr., President of the United States, has signed into law the allocation of almost $61 billion in foreign aid to Ukraine that was approved by the House of Representatives over the weekend, despite the best efforts of the, and I am quoting a Russian talk show here, the demonstrably heterosexual Marjorie Taylor Greene. Did you guys see that?
You're serious, aren't you?
Yes. There was a Russian talk show where they were talking about Marjorie Taylor Greene. They were calling her Moscow Marjorie as a compliment. And they were talking about how she is a Western beauty who wears these lovely white furs, and she is, quote, demonstrably heterosexual, unquote. And I got to tell you, there are a lot of personal trainers in Georgia who would agree.
Whoa, yeah, wow. Like, talk about news of the weird. I had no idea. That doesn't surprise me, but it doesn't help the Russian asset narrative in her case either, does it?
Like, no.
Well, has she ever denied it? I don't know.
No.
She's like the leading dim bulb in right? Just in my opinion. Sorry, I'm...
Fair enough. No, I think that's... I mean, there's a real weirdness in the Republican Party, and there was... Some congressman on CNN on the weekend, you know, and he's on the State of the Union show, and he's like, I don't know, guys, I'm starting to think there may be some real Russian assets in the Republican Party. And everyone's like, you don't say. There seems to be this general kind of surprise. But I mean, it all stems from the fact that Putin hates all the same stuff. They hate all the wokeism, all the, you know, queer allyship, you know, treating people of color like they're human beings, and, you know, ending democracy and goose stepping everywhere. They all have the same hobbies. So they find more allegiance with Putin than they do with, you know, Joe Biden.
It would be easier to understand their stand if they were just outright pacifists, right? Or somebody like Bernie Sanders. I mean, you knew he was going to vote against this due to the Israel aspect. And that's what's interesting about this legislation, that it wasn't just, they seem to throw a whole bunch of stuff into this. The majority of the cash, of course, going to Ukraine.
But they only get one shot. They only get one shot at something like this because of how screwed up Congress is.
Yeah, because it took, what was it, 6 months to get to this point? This is, they've already been through this sort of, and then it was like, no, we want to concentrate on the border and just tying it to stuff that seemingly unrelated, but then it's all security issues. So then there's a slice for Israel and a slice for Taiwan. So it's pretty much just U.S. hegemony represented in these spheres, right? So, mm-hmm. But they finally managed to convince 101 Republicans to support it, mm-hmm. to get it through. And then, as you said, Robinette, I didn't know that. I should have known that, I guess. That's a total trivia question. Biden signing it into law on Wednesday. And I'm fairly sure that the planes were probably sitting humming, ready to go the second that the ink hit the page.
It sounds like it, yeah.
And not a moment too soon for Ukraine, of course, although I think this may be one of those things where this is going to be it, I feel. Mm. What are we up to now for American aid for Ukraine? $170 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the stresses there about humming and hawing about whether this should be sent, it's going to start cracking, I think, after this round.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're 2+ years in now. Here is more money, weapons, the usual. Some of it's for training. Advanced weapon systems, which is probably good in terms of protection of civilians, because they're getting hammered in places once again, some of the border cities in particular, and Odessa. So that's very necessary. And hopefully they will send that first. And I saw that, the footage of the TV tower. What was that again? The TV tower just getting smoked. And I guess you could argue in war that TV towers are a fair enough target, but it's when it hits the block of flats next to it and hospitals,
yeah,
and all of those things. If they had stronger protections, things along the lines of what we see in Israel, which U.S. also pays for.
Well, I think there's a political angle to this that as sort of these wars roll on, it's harder and harder to justify the case. I mean, and this is kind of a typical thing in the span of American history, that wars are easy to get into, and there's a lot of immediate support. People are excited to support. Maybe excited is the wrong word, but and then the longer it goes on, the more, and this is like World War II as well. Like near the end of World War II, people are getting fed up with fighting that, and it's the way the will of the country seems to be. And of course, added to that is an election year, and it's been pointed out there's already going to be sort of a rough ride in September, because they're going to have to pass another funding bill for the government in September. That's a couple of weeks before the election. It's possible someone might try and attach like more Ukraine or more foreign aid into that bill. That's going to be a tough bill to swallow. But there's still the essential question of this, which is, how much is a war between Ukraine and Russia worth, when Ukraine losing probably means another war with Russia in Poland or one of the Baltic countries, which will surely, Putin's not going to go, well, having conquered Ukraine, I guess I'm done. Of course he's not going to be like that. And that seems to be the persuasive point of the argument. It's like, would you rather send $60 billion to Ukraine so that they can keep fighting, or would you rather send American troops if Russia attacks Poland? I think the math on that is pretty clear for a lot of people. But as we've kind of seen in recent years, elections make people do strange things that may not necessarily fall within, let's call them, logical parameters.
Oh, yeah. And if it's Trump again, all bets are off if there were any bets. There definitely won't be anything further, I don't think, for Ukraine if should Trump get elected. I guess it depends on how the House and the Senate shape up realistically, but he can he can veto it, right? So
that lame duck period, if Trump wins again in November, like from November to January, because you have Donald Trump. I don't know if you saw this one. Donald Trump gave, I don't know what this is exactly, because it's the first time I've heard of it, he gave the key to the White House to the former Japanese prime minister in a little photo op in the lobby of Trump Tower. this week.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that within his purview as an ex-president to do that? Or
I have no idea. It's literally the first time I've ever heard of the key to the White House. I'm going to Google key to the White House, see if it's a real thing. Hold on.
Maybe his people just made it up.
There's a book called The Keys to the White House.
Oh. But that'll be about people coming in the back door when Kennedy was president or something, right? I don't know.
It could be. It could be very much.
That's just a random guess, and it would be funny if it was about Kennedy. I don't know, but
It's so bizarre. He's so bizarre. But I mean, if you have like the gist I'm trying to get at is like Donald Trump's pretending to be the president by like giving out like fake keys, question mark. It's I don't know. It's bizarre. Well,
as we know, he actually won, right? So understandable that he's still in the role, but
dude, they stole it from him.
Yeah, didn't, completely.
I think I've heard some testimony about that.
I bet he's hasn't used a key since he was a teenager or something. When you're Trump, you get people open doors for you, right?
That's a great
in
point.
In more ways than one. But
that's a great point. I feel like we've gotten off target, though.
We have, yes. So back to Ukraine, which, of course, isn't really a laughing matter. I think the intention is, or something that will come from this, it'll spur Europe into doing a bit more. I think they're maybe doing what they can with some money this week from Britain, an aid package of $800 million in Canadian dollars. So, yeah, I guess Britain kind of acting on its own now rather than still part of NATO, but not part of Europe anymore as tightly. So as to what will come down from Europe remains to be seen. But I mean, there's obviously a lot of nervousness, but also they will be happy with this package as well.
I mean, it's a rare point of, I guess, good news for Ukraine, because they've been getting hammered the last couple of months by, I mean, Russia still has the advantage in terms of weapons and just, you know, having the military the size that they have. I mean, they've been sort of pissing away resources, you know, sort of one defeat on the other. And the interesting thing is that a lot of people have noted that despite that, the Ukrainian army has essentially been fighting with like rocks and sticks the last few months. Russia has
Museum
made
Pieces any- was one that I saw of like these guys with a machine gun. I'm like, is that what I think it is? And they said, oh. I was asking them personally, but I'm like, I'm seeing this gun. And I'm like, I think that looks like something out of, yeah, like World War II. And that's what's going on.
It belongs in a museum.
Yeah.
To get back to a joke.
Smash the glass and get the fish. Yeah, it'll be okay. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a reference to a joke nobody heard when before we started recording, but no, it's, you know, the despite that, Russia hasn't really made any serious ground. Like they've been hammering with like bombs and air attacks, but you know, they haven't really gained any territory. So it is you know, it could mean something. I think on the other hand, I think there's this kind of like hangover from last year where like this time last year we were like, oh, Ukraine's gonna go on the offensive and they're gonna take back Crimea, and then that, like, that didn't come to pass.
No. But I think that's because that like the Russian line is well entrenched now. They've taken the time. It's like 1,000-kilometer line if you look at it on a map from Crimea right on up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's those sorts of fortifications are difficult to break at the best times, let alone when your equipment
is and
you're low on personnel and you're low on material. Like there's no chance you're getting through that. So it's a stalemate of a sort. But then of course the question is, with this dump of money, will that even be enough to break that line?
So, I mean, $60 billion is one of those numbers that it like sounds like a lot, but when you're like buying bullets and bombs and missiles, and I mean that you can spend $60 billion a lot when you're arming for a war against a superpower.
Oh yeah, it'll go quickly.
Yeah. Before we move on to the next topic, I just want to read this portion from an article I found on Newsweek as we were talking. Quote, Jared Kushner, the ex-president's son-in-law and former White House advisor, wrote in his 2022 memoir, Breaking History, that his father-in-law designed keys for special guests. They were etched with the presidential seal and the words, quote, key to the White House, unquote.
So it's something that the Trump team made up and didn't exist until he was there. It's a PR thing.
That is correct.
Does it work on the front door? That's the question.
I mean, in so much as anything is made up, yeah, this is something Trump made up. It's not like Washington's key. They're all mold of the key that Washington was given when the White House opened. Actually, I don't think he was president when they finished the White House. I think that was Adams who was their first.
I want to get one cut at Keys Express or whatever and see if it
opens. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
Trump gave me this. It works.
I just want a spare, you know? Speaking of keys, you wouldn't need the keys to your car if we had better regional transit, but we don't. Last week, the government of Ontario, it was a little bit weird because they sent the premier out to Milton to essentially announce the semi-annual changes to the GO Transit schedule that tends to happen every April and September. But one of the things people noticed is that, yeah, there was more trains added to the Kitchener line in midday and around rush hour. Those trains stop in Bramley. They do not go all the way to the end of the Kitchener line, which, as you may have guessed, is Kitchener. And so it begs the question, what does it take to get more transit out here? And not just the trains, too. You know, just sort of going around the horseshoe, so to speak, the Golden Horseshoe, there's really no direct transit connections from Guelph to Orangeville or Cambridge or London or Niagara. And there's no Express Toronto bus service either. If you want to go to Toronto on the GO bus, like on the weekend when there's no GO train, it's a 2.5 hour trip through Brampton or a 2.5 hour trip through Mississauga. And that's probably not going to encourage you to get on the GO bus, especially when back in the old days of the Greyhound, it was an hour and a half express trip. Now, a lot of that is just the increase in traffic on the road. And, you know, I think the last time I took the Greyhound, it was about 2 hours. And this was like at 9-10 o'clock at night to get from Toronto. So it's, you know, traffic has certainly had an impact. But I mean, we definitely don't have the connectivity we want or frankly need if the intention is to sort of get more cars off the road and get more people onto transit.
Oh, yeah. I remember some of those epic rides and no devices.
That's right.
You got a newspaper maybe and you're just Walkman. In the middle of the worst was that connector in Brampton from that. Well, you were on a lot, right? The Georgetown GO bus. And then you're in Brampton and it's 45 minute wait for the night. I was never able to figure out why that ran like that. Now, I mean, that line is still there. I'm going to assume it's somewhat improved. I haven't been on that bus in a while, but of course the trains are supposed to make up the slack. These non-existent train rides are supposed to make up for it. But yeah, as far as it comes to transit and other things too, this isn't a serious province.
Mm-hmm.
I think about it a lot when I'm in, I haven't been lately, but in other places.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just use G7 as an example, other G7 nations in terms of where you can get to. And everywhere, people in these places will complain about transit to no end. But compared to what we have, even in their sort of diminished state, I'm thinking Britain in particular, where I've spent a lot of times on trains and buses.
Mm-hmm.
There's no comparison.
Mm-hmm.
It just blows us away in terms of where you can go. Example, like one time the relatives came from going from Port Credit into Union, and they couldn't believe, like, it was an hour then on the Lakeshore line, which has improved, so that's some improvement, I suppose, but they couldn't believe the size of the damn thing when it pulled up. How gigantic a GO train is. So we seem to have this, I'll call it North American mentality in terms of moving people around. It just needs to be this massive lumbering thing rather than the smaller, tighter trains like the Up Express, which is, I haven't been on it, but I've seen it. It's like that's, even though it only goes 4 stops, but it goes faster. That's a quality train.
Well, I mean, that's why people were using it, right? Instead of the GO train, because it goes the same portion of tracks that go up to Bloor and Etobicoke North, and then goes to Pearson instead of continuing on the Metrolinx lines. And one of the changes Ford announced was that, well, every half hour, they're not going to go to those two stops. They undid that decision. But, you know,
In record time,
you know, it was like that day.
Mind-blowingly fast, right?
But, I mean, there's to your point, there's a reason why people were taking the Up Express as opposed to the subway or the GO train. It's just like you get up there quicker. It's every half hour. You're getting up there like much faster. Especially to like the Bloor stop, where you cut through like downtown, you cut through the subway traffic, the bus traffic, the regular traffic, and you're there on Bloor, and then it's a hop skip to let's call it sort of like the looser ends of the number two line, because a lot of that there's a real bottleneck there between like Spadina and University, as you know, you're hitting all the transfer points. So
yeah.
It was much smoother. And of course, like, well, we're going to get, you know, this easy time you have using this particular stretch of track. Forget about it. That's not for you. We're going to use it. Just, you know, it really speaks to how little. Well, it speaks to number one. I saw Sean Marshall, who's like a transit, regional transit. I don't want to call him an expert. I don't want to call him nerd either, because it sounds like I'm sort of like poo-pooing him, because he does. I think he does have like genuine expertise through his coverage. But he's making the point. It's like it shows you how little sort of autonomy Metrolinx has now. It's like a fully utilized appendage of the Ministry of Transportation, and that's really not how it's meant to be.
Right.
So. And then at the same time, you sort of have people making decisions about what to do with the transit system that don't seem to pay attention to transit or use it, which is another big problem.
Yes, people will be driven to use, it's like anything, shortest distance, right? If Weston, which is a traditionally underserviced area, if you take TTC from Union to Weston, it's an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. If you take the Up Express, it's 15 minutes. What are you gonna do? What are you gonna go for? You're gonna take that because it's the fastest route. But that is the problem with Metrolinx, which I believe is supposed to be hands off, that it's politicized now.
Mm-hmm.
But also we see it in like this announcement, where it will be they just sort of put it out there, and it was repealed on Twitter. It was, I've heard people's concerns. Ford will always say, I've talked to hundreds of people. Like, I believe I've seen an ad about that. But then, you know, when a petition comes down with thousands of names that says, don't do this, they acted pretty quickly. So it made me wonder whether, is that blowback coming from just the people, or is there somebody corporate, like the airport authority, said, you know, backtrack on this, because it doesn't make sense. A lot of what they do in instances like this don't make sense, but this in particular, like we said, record's broken. But you know, wouldn't the logical step from this be, we need to structure more transit like the Up Express? And the Up Express, it's not that it's there accidentally, but it was put in for the Pan Am Games. Because going back to G7, this was the only province or one of the countries where, like, the major airport in the country doesn't have direct transit.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get New York. I can name the countries, places I've been, where it's like you just get the train.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what it took. And if people are, you know, a secondary use for it, but I mean, I think a lot of the workers of the airport use it too.
I'm sure.
So it's not just passenger traffic from Union. You can't assume that every single person, you know, in Toronto is going to Union to get to the airport. But, you know, you will congregate there if options are made available. But if it takes if you're somewhere in Etobicoke and it takes 2 hours to get to Union, you know, you're probably going to get an airport taxi or something, right?
Right. And I think that's right. And I think you've hit on something that, you know, if you create something, even if it's not, because I think the whole thing about shaving the two stops off, just making it direct, was Union to Pearson, was like, we're trying to get this back to what it was intended for. Well, sometimes with these things, people decide how they want to use it outside of what you intended to use it for. And, you know, we see that a lot in Guelph with the allowance for the amount of time to transfer. You know, people decide, like, it's supposed to like give you time to make your connections and things. But, you know, people have decided that they're going to use it in their own way that makes sense to them for the trips they're taking. That should be the lesson here, is that, you know, smaller trains, faster trains, more frequent trains. But I'll be damned if that won't be the lesson taken from any of this. And to answer your other question about taking the bus to Brampton, I will tell you, they have renamed downtown Brampton into like Brampton's Innovation District or something like that.
Oh.
You can rename downtown Brampton, but downtown Brampton is the same as it ever was 30 years ago. I'll leave that there.
It could be quite a creepy stop at night.
It is interesting.
I'm sure that hasn't changed. I'm visualizing that the last time we were through there.
The only thing,
the same. Maybe more condos, right? But
I don't think there's even more condos. The only thing open was the 7-Eleven, and it was like a 5-minute walk from a bus station.
Well, yeah, and that was it too. Like you get there, everything's closed, and you have 45 minutes.
Yeah, it's great stuff. Great stuff, Patrick.
We're sitting ducks here.
Patrick Brown's doing great stuff downtown. We're gonna take a quick break and come back with some Guelph stuff with Aaron Caton. You're listening to Open Sources Guelph. You're on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
That's a band called Scenic Route to Alaska from their new album. They're from Edmonton, which I guess if you go from Edmonton to Alaska, it's the
That's probably scenic.
That's a self-released album, and the song was Here Goes Nothing, which is probably what I say when I wake up every day. No, not really. Some days.
Well, I think that's what some members of city council say when they sit down every meeting. But I digress. That's obviously a reference to our guest this week, Ward 1 Councillor Aaron Caton. They are someone who is well versed in tech savviness because they worked in Silicon Valley before coming to Guelph. So when there was a meeting last week about some of the mayor's social media posts getting complaints to the integrity commissioner, it was Aaron who suggested that perhaps city council might benefit from some more stringent rules around social media and some social media training. The motions that Aaron presented were adopted unanimously, so we talked about that. And coming up in May, this is a bit of a council sneak preview, there is probably going to be a motion coming forward about internet voting and having that for the 2026 election. This is going to be an initiative that the Accessibility Advisory Committee has been pushing very, very strongly for. And Aaron, because they are an advocate for people with disabilities, being someone who has an environmental sensitivity, is obviously an ally. So we talked a little bit about internet voting and whether or not there will be council support for that as well. So now that I have laid the table so beautifully, beautiful table, we're going to throw it to our interview with just can't get it out of your head, can you? We're going to throw it to our interview with Aaron Caton starting right now. Okay, Aaron Caton, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, I wanted to just address, you brought a motion or a couple of motions to council last week in regards to an integrity commissioner's report. It wasn't so much in regards to what was in the report, but it was in regards to sort of some of the issues around the report about just how our council and the city seem to be lacking in terms of rules around social media. And I find it interesting, you know, the motions came from you who have this like tech background and are obviously maybe tech savvy in a way that, not to cast aspersions, but, you know, our council hasn't exactly had some of the of our community's most tech savviest people at the table before. But but you know, just to get your reaction to it, you know, are you feeling good about, like, actually let me rewind even a bit in terms of, like, in terms of tackling the issue of tech savviness and social media and having these sort of guidelines on council, like, how big of a priority has this been for you? Like, is it something that was kind of been in the back of your head for a while?
Yeah, I had a bit of a tumultuous campaign, and there was a lot of stuff going around on social media. And I know that the integrity rules only apply to sitting councillors, but especially during the election, we didn't have a lot of rules and regulations around what was proper use of social media. And there were a lot of candidates who had forums and things that they were monetizing and were kind of on the cusp of business. And there was no way to address any of that. And as someone who has been online for a long time, I don't want to age myself, but it's been a while. It was a bit surprising to me because those seem pretty obvious uses. And when you've got full government saying, you know, we don't use TikTok, we don't do this, we don't do that, then why aren't we keeping up with social media in terms of our own policies?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I wonder, until the motions you brought forward last week and your ward mate kind of got around this point too, it's like it just seems like it's not work that the clerk's office, who are kind of the, for people who may not be aware of how our governance works, are kind of the referees and the rule makers for these things. There seems to be, I guess, I don't want to ascribe motivations to them, but they seem to be, I guess, hesitant to sort of, like, making things too prescriptive. And I guess, is it, from your experience sort of working on these issues, do you, are you, or has your experience been, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this, but, you know, there's kind of a gap between not wanting to be overly prescriptive and sort of, like, dealing with the world as it is, like, especially the online world. Like, are these things having trouble coexisting?
Yeah, and I think that when you're talking about ethics and how to do fair elections, you can't really use the Southern Belle approach and rely on the kindness of strangers, right? Like, people are going to do what they're going to do. And if you want people who are willing to adhere to, like, there's a lot of bureaucracy when you're on council. There's a lot of, this is the process, these are the rules, these are the ways that we do things. And going into it, you should be aware of that, right? And I don't think that social media is something that is separate from that system, right? It's just an extension of it. And a lot of people rely on their own counselors to get news about the city. They don't want to follow every account in the world, and they want stuff that's specific to their ward. So us having rules and regulations around that isn't a hard thing to do. There's, like, the differences in how we do it. There's a lot to do with, like, personal versus is it actually owned by the corporation and other things like that. But those are all things that can be discussed and nuanced. But the idea that we need to have those discussions and then create something around that is what I really wanted to push forward.
So do you have, like, remedies in mind? Like, and this is something I think Dan Gibson was kind of trying to get at too. And not, again, trying not to put words in his mouth, but people may not know that when you are a city councilor and you get elected and you go in for your orientation, you get a City of Guelph phone with a City of Guelph phone number. You get your City of Guelph email address through which you're expected to handle your city councilor business. You get a city council tablet through which you get all this agenda management stuff that through which you hold the meetings. So you get all this, like, hardware. are you envisioning that maybe part of that is you get like an official Ward 1, like in your instance, like social media account, where you get the Ward 1 Twitter account, the Ward 1 Facebook page, the Ward 1, I don't know, TikTok or Instagram or Snapchat or whatever? Like, is that kind of something, or is that kind of maybe overly prescriptive in terms of what you're thinking about?
Well, when it comes to things like websites and newsletters and email lists, I think those should be owned by the city. I think that right now what we've got going on is a mishmash of personal expenses that are kind of expected. And if the person who runs those accounts doesn't get elected in the next term, then you have to start all over. So for, you know, what I'm concerned is the residents' user experience, for lack of a word, right? So you want to keep it consistent for the people in the different wards as to where they're supposed to go and look for things, right? And I don't think it's bad to have a corporate use social media account that's owned and run by the counselor, right? That has different rules and regulations. I don't think that necessarily has to be owned by the city, but having a MailChimp that is so that you're not able to use people's emails for campaigning and donations and things like that, because there's a conflict of interest in terms of finances, I find. Same thing for the websites, right? So you have your own campaign website that's different than the ones that people need to come to find out about, you know, what's going on in the park nearby, why is this traffic being blocked, and other things that people regularly want to find out about that's just ward specific. And then that way it's there for everybody, no matter who has been elected. And then you've got two different counselors who have each equal access to it. And so we're kind of making a difference between campaigning and, you know, information gathering.
Right. Okay. I think a lot of people may not understand, because I think, you know, you have people like Councillor Caron who says, like, I have Facebook and Twitter and things, and it's under my name, and I manage it, and it's just me, and I'm just using it to share city business. And then you have the mayor who's not only sharing, you know, city business, he's like, I went to a garage sale, and I got this weird knickknack today.
Yeah. And so, like, if you want to get the after council video, then you also have to hear about rummage sales and everything else. And, like, and maybe you're into both, right? Who knows?
Yeah.
But I try to keep mine separate, just because, you know, I've had Aaron on Twitter, so I've been on there forever. And I didn't think that most of the people who have followed me over the years for, like, tech stuff and disability advocacy and everything else care, to be quite frank,
sure.
Most of the stuff that's happening in Guelph. And so I separated them all out. And also because I didn't want to have that conflict later on in terms of elections and things. So the things that I use to campaign with, I keep those separate. And I've got my council accounts for that information.
Probably not a lot of people in Silicon Valley that care about road work on Starwood, but point taken.
Like, maybe I'm the reason people move to Guelph. You never know.
It could be. It could be. Look at all the work they're doing on Starwood. This is a city of the future.
Yeah.
Sort of along with these internet issues or these social media issues, I wanted to get your perspective on something that's coming up to Committee of the Whole as we're recording on Tuesday. The agenda hasn't dropped yet, but I know it is coming, and I know you know it's coming too, this recommendation for the 2026 municipal election. And this is kind of where your two Venn diagrams overlap with disability advocacy and your council work, because I know, and you know, because we both watch these meetings, the AAC has been pushing hard for, like, every possible elections alternative option, and the clerks have been very pragmatic and saying, like, well, we can't do every option. I wonder, well, first of all, I want to get your reaction to sort of, like, the debate has been so far, because I think things have been pretty cordial, but there have been, I think, some heat from some friction. And I just, from your point of view, sort of watching all this go down, have you been feeling that friction too?
Yeah, like, I watched that last one, and the fact that Chair Root stepped down from chairing so that she could, you know, basically voice her opinions in a much more free manner was a little bit indicative of kind of the way things have been going. I know having chat with her, she's been trying to get something going since 2014, which was the last time we had online voting, mm-hmm. because she hasn't been able to vote independently. And that, I have so many feelings about this one, because again, what you said earlier about it not being a necessarily tech forward council kind of comes to play with this, but it's not the same council. And that was 10 years ago in terms of tech. And there's a lot of really interesting things that are not necessarily tech-based, but are more process-based, where you can make online voting safer. And honestly, it is the most accessible option. And it is going to be the same cost, no matter how many people are using it. And there's a piece of software that Chair Root has brought up before, and actually delegated for accessible voting before I ran for council in the same meeting that she presented this one in. And it's a digital ballot for folks, and then you mail it in, right? Mm. And that would help people fill out their ballots at home online. And when people use kind of abusive families as their reason why we can't move forward with this, it really, really, to be frank, pisses me off, because it's the exact same reasons why people who are very low vision want to have these systems, because you can't independently vote. You can't verify your vote. You don't know if someone's being coerced. You don't know if someone's actually doing what you ask them to do in terms of marking your ballot. There's no way for you to know that you are getting an independent private vote. And it's okay to fight for it. And I do agree, like we should be fighting for, you know, people who are living in abusive homes to be able to get this. But a lot of those people are disabled, right? And they can't get out to vote. They can't do what they want to do, right? I had heard, and I can't remember which of the territories it was, because I was reading this article a while ago. There was a poli-sci computer person at one of the local universities, and they were saying that one of the territories has a sign up to online vote. So basically, if you're going to do an absentee vote, or like your mail-in vote version, then you register for that. Mm. And so if you want to make it, you know, something that's slightly more restrictive or prescriptive, then that's one of the ways you can do it. So it's the marriage of technology and process that is really needed here. No one's saying like, just let loose, have no standards, no way to check on the votes, no way to verify afterwards. No one wants that, right? But there are ways to do it, and having in-person voting as well as some online voting, I think would be really good. And I don't know, like, for sure that it would increase the number of people who are willing to vote, but anytime you make something easy, more people are going to use it.
Right.
So it seems like a win-win to me.
Right. And I'm not sure anyone's against the win and the win. I think, and, you know, again, I'm sort of reading minds, but I think that what the clerks are hesitant about is creating new things. Whether that is like embracing technology that hasn't been used before in Canada, which, okay, well, somebody's got to go first, or, you know, this having a system where people sign up in advance to get an internet ballot. It just seems like, this may be a thing that's solved, like, well, what if we hire like an accessibility voter advocate or coordinator, who can do this sort of specialized work? And I don't know what that person's job qualifications would look like, but there just seems to be a mental barrier, whether that is, embracing the new ideas of this way of voting, because I don't think anyone's going to come out against, like, well, not everyone's equal. You know, some animals are more equal than others, or come out with that argument. But, you know, there is a practical consideration that is going to be the hardest part to overcome in the debate, no matter what form the debate takes.
Yeah. Accessibility is not about how many people need a thing.
Right.
It's about everybody deserves the same access as everybody else. And if it's something that can be used by people who are not disabled, then all the better, right? And in many cases, it can be, right? Like, just on a pure lazy note, my handwriting is awful. And if I really need to, you know, digitally print my ballot, then I would take that. So, and I'm sure I'm not the only person. I think that if that's the choice that kind of gets council past the technophobia situation, is that it's very specific to that one system, then I think it's a good deal. I think that back then, I believe Chair Root had said that because we were going to be the potentially first, there is going to be a discount situation. I don't know if that has now sailed. So that's something I'm not aware of in terms of cost. But it would seem very, very bizarre to me to put a cost on democracy and to have accessibility being the last factor in that. It's just abhorrent.
Yeah, I think that's I think that's right. I think, again, it's one of those things where I think a lot of people would agree. And I just, you know, in terms of knowing your colleagues the way you do at this point, you know, looking back at those past councils, there were some people who used to sit on council who, let's say, were enjoyed a certain longevity, who are no longer there. There has been a shift in sort of representation with, you know, younger people. People of our generation probably make up the majority of council, not necessarily people who grew up with computers in the home. But I mean, I didn't have a computer in my house when I grew up, but I certainly had computers at school that I was able to access. And I guess how much of this is sort of a generational thing? And are you anticipating that this may be a council receptive to just saying, yeah, it's 2024, by the election is 2026, we should have internet voting?
I would hope that, but so there's a lot of folks on council that I think are progressive on a very large number of topics. They're very progressive socially, but when it comes to the technology, less so. I don't know if I have the votes, to be honest. I think we have more votes than we would have last term. I don't want to call him out, but I use Councillor Ault as my as my guy when it comes to, you know, progressive on one end and not necessarily on the other.
Yeah.
So whenever I have ideas like this, I try to run past him, and I'm like, if I can convince Phil, then I can convince the world, sort of thing.
That's interesting.
So, but I think that there are ways to do it. And when I was chatting him up the other day about the difference between the process and other things, he was listening more intently. So I think that if we had some structure around it and it wasn't just kind of like an open field, then I think to potentially get past.
And I think that, you know, in weird circumstance, thanks to the Ontario government, we're going to have a bit more structure that has nothing to do with us, because we're going to be using the Elections Ontario list next election instead of MPAC. So we're going to be eliminating this situation where you're at a house and you get 16 voter registration cards because MPAC has 16 people living at that address on their list.
Yeah, I also found just like, I understand why they do it, but I thought it was weird that you get a list of voters to go door to door with. That seems weird to me. So about privacy and everything else, then everybody who campaigns for something gets, you know, the yellow pages of wealth, basically, for voters. And I think that's kind of an old school way of doing things that we don't need to do it anymore.
Yellow pages is a reference that some of our listeners may have to look up. But in our in our last couple of minutes, though, I mean, I just, again, I don't want to pigeonhole you, but you do identify as a member of our local queer community. It's almost Pride Month. You know, and looking back at last fall, there was a lot of, you know, hatred in the ether, a lot of, you know, bigotry in the ether. I can't help, and maybe it's because I don't identify as queer, so I'm not confronted with it as much. A lot of that seems to have tapered off to some degree. And I'm wondering if this, you know, might be a more relaxing Pride Month for our local queer friends than last year.
Well, I don't know about like Pride itself having any issues with folks kind of coming in. That didn't happen when I was there last year, but I've had to go to the police this year with one of my fans being particularly insistent. And there is a couple of other folks that like to pick and choose counselors that they dislike a lot. And
right.
I had to stop posting pictures online of my daughter because they were using pictures of my daughter in videos and stuff like that. Like it's the, this is why we can't have nice things sort of behavior. There are those people, they're going to be mad no matter what you do. So I try not to, well, I never consider them when I'm doing things because it's not about them, right? It's about being a good person and having an amazing society that's filled with people who all have their own path. And saying like, just because that's not a path that I understand or want to be a part of, I don't want to walk that path, but like, looks lovely over there, have fun, you know, do your walk. And some people just can't do that. They're constantly straying from their own path. They're worried about what's going on the other side. And even if it doesn't affect them, they're going to come over and try to cause chaos because ultimately they're just not very happy. And, I don't think it's kind of gone down. I just am really adept at blocking. If someone is going to spout a bunch of bigotry and hatred at me, then I'm going to block you. And I really recommend that for your own peace of mind, if you're somebody who is subject to hate of any type, whether it be from the queer, if you're in the queer community or another equity deserving group, that you just take that and keep your own peace and protect it, because these folks are going to be mad no matter what. And I hope that everybody has a great Pride. I know that I'm going to have fun. And you know, people got over the crosswalk and they got it just, they have a moment and they need to kind of push through it and decide to do something positive for themselves rather than hate on others, right?
One would hope. And I hope this has been very positive. Certainly I, and Aaron, you have real fans, so don't even worry about it. I know some of them. So, but thank you for your time today, Aaron. It's always appreciated. And we will see you around the council tables.
Great. Thank you so much.
Okay. So once again, that was Aaron Caton, Ward 1 City Councilor. And of course, stay tuned because we got, we had Kathy Downer on a couple weeks ago. So that means 2 down, 11 to go.
Mm.
We'll get them all. We'll get them, my pretty. I'm not sure.
Like Pokemon or whatever. Just, well, we will.
Sure, yeah. Sure. We'll gotta get them all. Yeah, yeah. Wow. It's more modern reference than my Wicked Witch of the West.
Our roles have reversed.
All right, that's it for this week's show. We hope you liked it. You can listen to it again by downloading it every Monday from our website, opensourcesguelph.com, from the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or through your favorite app like Apple, TuneIn, and Spotify. Stay connected to us on the socials. We're on Facebook at Open Sources Newswire, and we're on Twitter at OS_Guelph. I will be back here on CFRU Wednesday at 3 p.m. for the movie review show that I co-host called End Credits. And you can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can check out my news and politics site at guelphpolitico.ca.
And for the latest on our glorious royal family, you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Blue Sky at Scotty Hertz. And if you're joining us at our regular time on a Thursday at 5, please stay tuned at 6 for the volunteer playlist.
Yes, that is one of the many great programs that you will hear on this station, CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. As for this show, Open Sources, we'll be back next Thursday at 5 p.m. for another new edition, and we will see you then.